With me in the studio is Studs Terkel, who you probably know through his books and through his syndicated radio show, as well as his many appearances on TV. Studs Terkel has traveled around the world as a journalist, but he's lived most of his life in Chicago. He went to the University of Chicago Law School, but never practiced law. Instead, he's worked as a jazz disc jockey. He's acted in theater, on television, and in radio soap operas. He's also well-known as an interviewer of both the famous and the obscure. Since 1945, he's worked at radio station WFMT in Chicago, which is where his nationally syndicated radio series originates. Most of his guests at WFMT are well-known, writers, musicians, and politicians. But he also interviews many lesser-known people, and he's done this for his five books of oral histories. The books have titles like Working, Hard Times, and American Dreams Lost and Found, and they're collections of interviews with ordinary Americans about very basic aspects of their lives. Studs Terkel's most recent book is also an oral history. It's called The Good War, and it's a compilation of men's and women's recollections of World War II. The interviews recount people's experiences of being in battle, of life on the home front, the secret development of the atom bomb, and the conditions of black soldiers in segregated platoons. Studs Terkel's other books include Giants of Jazz, Division Street America, Hard Times, an oral history of the Great Depression, Working, American Dreams Lost and Found, and Talking to Myself, which is a memoir. The Good War, his new book, is published by Pantheon Books. Earlier today, Studs Terkel spoke at the Philadelphia Inquirer's Book and Author Luncheon. Welcome to Fresh Air. It is really a great pleasure to meet you. Let's talk first about your new book, the World War II Oral Histories, and then we'll talk about your life. And I wanted to ask you, like, with World War II, it dawns on me, I grew up in the 50s, and mm-hmm. I didn't live through the war, but so many people when I was growing up did. But now in the 80s, there's a lot of people who don't have any firsthand connection at all with the war. Are you concerned that these are memories that are going to be forgotten?
My concern, I'm worried stiff, not simply not any memories of World War II. Many of the young have no memories of yesterday. I mean, Vietnam is ancient history to them. You see, when we have a presidential candidate who is president who says Vietnam was a noble adventure, we should have won, this standing history on its head, standing truth upside down, and getting away with it tells me we have no sense of past, no memory. And so this book, or the other oral histories, so-called, are attempts to recapture what it was like to live at a certain moment in history, in a certain circumstance, whether it be the Great Depression, the 30s, what was it like for the ordinary person, so-called? Or during World War II, what was it like to be this woman in this plant? Or to be a child growing up, your predecessors? Or what was it like to be a young soldier here, there? Or an English woman during the Blitz? Or a 15-year-old Russian soldier, a girl, on the Stalingrad front? What was it like? And that's what, in a sense, is my impulse, you might say.
World War II has been called the last just war. It's been called the good war. That's the title you gave your book, The Good War. Do you believe that it was the last just war or a good war?
You notice I have the title in quotes. Now, that's not to make an editorial comment. I have it in quotes because it's a phrase that was used. I'm quoting my contemporaries, myself included, too. Good war, that was Hitler, the maker of the Holocaust, Imperial Japan, the bombing of Pearl Harbor, all that, yes, in contrast to the obscenity that is the Vietnam adventure, good. But was it? No war. You know, it's good and war. The noun and the, I have a little note in the beginning, how the noun and the adjective, good and war, never match. Even that war made savages of decent young people. Even that war. Heroism, yes, but savages too, especially in the Pacific theater. And there had to be race. There's no question. They did to Japanese corpses what they would never do to German corpses, hammer out the gold teeth and things like that. Well, but they were decent kids, all of them. Decent kids. I'm not talking about SS or those guys. I'm talking about the Imperial Japan, but the Bohatai, the young Japanese soldiers, German kids, 15, 14, our own kids. They're all the same kids, pimply-faced, acneed, scared stiff, doing a certain heroic act. For whom? For the kid next to him, not for an abstraction like flag or God or country.
Do you think wars encourage latent racism to come to the surface? Because like you point out, a lot of people tell you in the book that, one person says that the drill instructors at boot camp tell them, you're not going to Europe, you're going to the Pacific, don't hesitate to fight the Japs dirty. And there was a distinction
made. He didn't
made.
Say that about going to the European theater.
Mm-hmm.
He said that there. And just remember, one of the ironies of World War II, the war of liberation, and we did liberate, and we, not we alone, we and our allies, and that includes, we have to say, the Soviet Union. They lost 20 million people. We seem to forget that. So when Reagan goes to celebrate 40th anniversary of Normandy D-Day, we did it by ourselves. Did we? 4 to 5 Germans lost their lives on the Eastern Front. As guys say, you go to any German house, you find a blackboarded picture. You may remember the movie The Sorrow and the Pity, Marcel Offel's documentary, and this Nazi general, the black borders, wherever they were so scared of going to the Eastern Front, you know. But coming back to your theme, it was a segregated army, you know. The blacks were doing the domestic work back there. You know, the irony is, Terry, you talk about irony, blacks had to be militant in order to have the right to risk their lives at the front because of that phony myth that they're not good soldiers. Well, the Tuskegee Airmen were terrific. A tank battalion led by a guy who's in the book named Charlie Gates was unbelievable. You know. But we have this aspect, and then we have the aspect of a grand alliance, a euphoric moment at the end of it, you know.
You weren't fighting in the war. You had a perforated eardrum.
Mm.
And I think you were maybe too old for the draft at the time.
No, I was 10 years. I was in the draft. I was
okay.
The special services. That's the same thing Reagan was in, by the way. I mean, he went to the front as much as I went to the front. Special services. It was entertaining and keeping the kids happy. And I and a crooked bailiff, who was about 40 years old, I was about 32, the average age of the kids was 20, 21. My bailiff friend taught them civics they never got in class, you know. And we did, as Othello would say, some service to the state in keeping the kids happy, you know.
Did you feel at all disappointed that you were sidelined from the front lines, that you weren't going to be on the battlefield?
I don't think anybody ever feels disappointed that he's not on the front lines. There are certain heroic guys, of course, that did feel that way. No, I volunteered later to go overseas again with Red Cross, but I didn't know till later on I was blacklisted. I found that out in my Freedom of Information files. I didn't know it then, because I signed many petitions. I signed all kinds of things, you know. Of course, I signed things anti-Jim Crow. That was considered subversive back then. In any event, I was excited about the war because it was against Hitler. There was a great consensus in contrast to the undeclared obscenities that followed, you know.
Did you ever feel like left out of this bond that other men of your generation had, because they had fought together?
Not really, no. It was there. It was an adventure we shared, pretty much. There were conscientious objectors, but they were relatively few in number, and there were isolationists. But it wasn't at all the protest, not nearly. That was a consensus. It was pretty generally accepted.
A lot of people know about World War II through Hollywood movies.
Oh, boy. Pauline Kael is in the book, too. But not only is she, but there's this woman, Deli Hahn, who recalls seeing these movies, how phony they really were. How should the humanity, those who were Japanese or Germans were automatically caricatured. None. And the humanity was drained out of them. But some of the bull, as Deli Hahn describes, soldiers in the audience watching George Murphy, the actor in the movie, jumping up and down, elated. He's elated. Why? Asked Lenny, I've just been drafted. I've just been... And the audience just howled because they knew it was bull. And Gene Kelly in one of the movies, Cover Girl, or one of them, Gene Kelly, he's not in. He's in civilian. How come? You know why? I want to... I'm wounded, you see, but I do my best entertaining the soldiers. So it was all this bull, really, when you think about the films. I saw one this morning. I was on some TV show, and they showed a short Frank Sinatra film called The House I Live In. And he's telling these kids about those Japs are going to get us. And I thought that horrible. That house I live in has a song that he sings. And it was written by a man named Lewis Allen. And it's a good song. And one of the lines is, my country, right or wrong. But if it's wrong, let's set it right. I wish old Frankie boy would follow that advice today and not back his pal Ronnie the way he does, which you don't question. If you question, you're disloyal, you know.
My guest is Studs Terkel, if you're just joining us, and his latest book is an oral history of World War II, and it's called The Good War in quotes. You've done so many oral histories. How much do you think memory can be trusted for oral history?
Of course, that's a very good question. It's an imponderable, you know. I think memory can be trusted. I really do. Even though some details may be off, as indeed my own memory plays tricks on me. I know that. But it is not the detail. And the details are important. Very often, details are telltale. But it's that what that person remembers is indelible for a certain reason. It was a certain moment in his or her life. And my best way to do it is I remember in the preface to Hard Times, my oral history of the Depression, I'm quoting Tom Joad from Grapes of Wrath. And the Joad family members going to California. You know, they've just been, the Okies have a rough time, the drought, and they go hoping in this land of milk and honey they'll find jobs. And somewhere on the way to California, another group is coming back. And, you know, there were 10,000 leaflets for 500 jobs. And this guy says, I'm going back home to starve. And so Tom Joad then asks his friend Preacher Casey, is this guy telling the truth? And he says, the truth for him. He's the truth for us. We'll find out. Well, in a way, the truth for him who's telling the story.
Do you ever find that, because I know this is true for me, that sometimes I'll change the story just a little bit in the telling, and then a few years later I'm not really sure which way it happened, the way I think I remember it or the way I've been telling it, and that memory just starts to play tricks with me.
Well, memory, you know, there's a quote, let me read the quote in the beginning. There's a couple of epigraphs, and one is a Tom Paxton song, What Did You Learn in School Today, Dear Little Boy of Mine, That Wars Are Good and all that, and that's what I learned in school today. But there's this quote about memory. It's a man named Bartlett, an Englishman, I think, remembering. In memory, we find the most complete release from the narrowness of presented time and place. Meaning, and now we come to my theme, I think. It's a liberation from this now of no memory. At this moment, I say, there's a lack of memory. There's a lack of knowledge of yesterday. So in memory, we find the release from that. The picture is one of human beings confronted by a world in which they can be masters, a world in which human beings can be masters only as they discover ways of escaping from the complete sway of immediate circumstances. Let's analyze that. They can be masters if they can just escape the immediate, saying, I'm doing great this minute. Oh, I'm voting for Ron. I'm doing great. Is that it? What happened before as it indicates what may happen tomorrow? There was a depression. There was unregulated stuff back then. And then the same guys whose bottoms were saved by the New Deal, condemn big government. You see, that's the irony. So it's in the knowledge of past. That's what he's talking. So remembering, memory can be a liberating experience, too.
Yeah, well, in the acknowledgments for your memoir, talking to myself, you know, you thank everybody who's helped you and everything. Then you say, and to my memory, a blessing and a curse.
Yeah. Oh, you remember that.
Now, how's your memory been a curse, though?
A blessing and a curse. You remember, you know, and sometimes you go crazy remembering a certain thing. That's what I meant. So I remember something maybe I shouldn't. I have a safety valve, but no, it comes back again. Then you have to deal with it, you see.
You've interviewed people who have never been interviewed before, and you've interviewed people who are very famous. Do you have a very different interview style when you're doing an oral history with someone, or when you're interviewing someone who just, like, wrote a book or is a famous actress?
No, it's the same. Naturally, when someone wrote a book, I got to read the book. I cannot. I know I'm always astonished at some of these TV programs, and I'll tell you about them in a minute. You know, those morning shows in which they all look the same in every city. The sweet, handsome boy, a guy and girl, and the token handsome young black guy looks like Harry Belafonte, or the token Puerto Rican girl, or now Asiatic guy or girl. But they all look identical. You can't tell one from the other. You don't know what city you're in. And you know they haven't read the book. They're very sweet. You got coffee, and you got a sweet roll, and you're next to a lady mud wrestler, you know, or someone who's a flower arranger. And he goes, and they're very nice, but they haven't the vaguest idea. And you talk, as a matter of rote, just to pass the time of the day, to survive them. Now, so I got to read the book, and that takes time. Now, I interview a person, the non-celebrated person, so-called, and it's to find out what that person is thinking, but you're exploring new territory. I say I'm like Columbus discovering a new land, and that this person has never been asked about his, her life before. And that person opens up, and a marvelous thing happens sometimes. And these are those great occasions when that person, in the days when the tape recorder was not as ubiquitous as it is now, that person, hey, could you play that back? I want to hear my voice. And the kids are around her, and you play it back, and that person says, you know, I never knew I felt that way before. Not I never knew I thought, I never knew I felt that way before. It's a tremendous moment of revelation for that person, and of course for me too. I'm kind of like a fellow passenger on a trip, in a way.
How far will you push, though, when you're doing a personal interview? Because some people really want to get someone to confide all their secrets and to break down and cry and reveal
mine's exactly
these
the
deep
opposite.
Emotional things.
No, mine's exactly the opposite. I never trespass on what I think is private domain of a person. But the person is telling me something that reveals a facet of a life, and it's personal, but it only because it reveals a facet of a life. That's a different thing. But just not gossip. No time for that. I'll tell you a story, okay? Years ago, I was interviewing Dana Barrymore. Dana Barrymore was the daughter of the great actor John Barrymore, and she died a number of years ago. Dana Barrymore, at that time, was the subject of scandal magazines. It was a horrible magazine called Confidential, God knows what, the Inquirer. Inquiring Minds read Inquirer. I love those commercials. They're obscene, really. This banal girl, this actress, plus I'm an inquiring mind, read Inquirer. It's almost a grotesquerie, you know. In any event, and so she's telling about this, and they go into her sex life, bizarre, her junkiness, her drinking. And it's just, then she acts in a Tennessee Williams play, suddenly last summer in Chicago. And she's wonderful. She was a marvelous actress in this play, the girl who's lobotomized. Later on, she did Maggie in Cat on a Hot Tin. So after seeing her in the Tennessee Williams play, I interviewed her. And we're talking about Tennessee Williams, the heroines, what they mean to her. And then we finished the interview, and it's rather good, I thought. She said, haven't you forgotten something? I said, well, I've forgotten a lot of things. What? You haven't asked me those questions. I said, what questions? Well, those questions about my life, you know, that everybody else asks. I said, none of my business. I says, nor the business of the reason. I want to find out about you through your artistry, through your craft. If I had Frank Lloyd Wright on, the architect, would I ask him about his wives? Whom he left, nor left him, or I ask about his architecture and why the Imperial Hotel withstood the Japanese earthquake, you know. And so in York, I ask you how you attack this girl, the role. And then she busts out crying. She says, no one has ever said that to me before. She came to accept that as the normal way of things, to accept humiliation. Well, I don't do it, serves no purpose. I don't do none of my business. That's like peeking through a keyhole or peeking through a transom. And, of course, I resent that very much. So the person tells me of his life with something involving that makes it universal. That's it. It's when somebody reads this, that happened to me. I thought the same thing. That's what I look for. A certain universality in a specific.
Do you think your interviewing's gone through different stages? You know, is the way you interview now the way you started when you began
interviewing? I don't know. Gee, I can't. I think it's different. I think I've gotten older and more of a easier way, I think. I'm not sure. I think you learn as you go along. You learn different people. But you still have to go round and round and round the mulberry bush. I mean, it's a conversation. And then, rather than interview, because sometimes I say something about myself maybe, too, if it helps, you know. Very often, you know, here's a tale out of school. I'm not very good mechanically. You know, I use the tape recorder, right? The tape recorder is my right arm. And I don't know how it works. You know, I can't drive a car. So I goof up a lot. unintentionally, that person helps me, the person I'm interviewing. And when that person helps me, something happens. That person feels needed by me. And to feel needed is terribly important. Many people don't feel needed, you see. So there's no one way. I clown around, horse around. And
so it's important for you to not be the star when you're interviewing somebody, not the famous Studs Terkel interviewing somebody.
No, well, you see, that becomes, I got to watch that, you see. Isn't that funny? You said the famous Studs Terkel. This is a guy who is in a half-assed way sort of celebrated for interviewing non-celebrated people, which is ironic, is it not, you know? If I took that seriously, I'd be a real oaf, wouldn't I, and a clod. Maybe I am, but I don't take it seriously, you know.
I know you have been interviewed around the country on radio and TV shows, but do you watch and listen to interview shows when you're at home, or does it drive you crazy to hear interviews after doing all the ones
that
you do?
It drives me crazy. Particularly the political ones, you know, when you watch those great newspaper guys on the Sunday morning shows, never ask the pertinent question. They don't, you see. We, unlike Russia and China, where there's a heavy hand of government, we know that. And so, guys, they have to be samizdatish, you know, they have to have underground ways of talking and codes. We don't have a heavy hand of government. We have something different, self-censorship. These guys and women know exactly what not to ask. They never ask about this bloated military budget, really. They never say this is lunacy to build more and more nuclear missiles if we can knock them 50 times over and they can do the same to us. They never ask why we're cuts are always in human resources and never the. They never say the welfare bums in the Pentagon, where the big welfare bums really are. You see, do they ever? No, they know you don't ask those questions. Now, that's censorship. Very subtle indeed, but it's there, just as heavy as the other.
So the political interviews frustrate you. What about interviews with authors and performers who you'd see on TV or the radio? Do you listen or watch any of those?
Interviewing performers is something I avoid to a great extent. Because generally speaking, you know what they're going to say. They're going to be a humility that's going to be put on that sweet, good, and really, and it's the same thing. And a plug in a movie, which is okay, you know. And authors, it depends if the person read the book or not, you know. And then I see authors sometimes being good authors, you know, going through this humiliating experience, you know. There's a pretense. The pretense to the audience is the author has to pretend the person read the book. The person has to pretend he read the book. And the audience watching has to pretend that having a conversation.
I must say, I've interviewed several people who you've interviewed, and one of the things that many of them have said is like, God, I walked into the studio and there was a copy of my book and it was dog-eared and it was scribbled on and I was so happy. He'd not only read it, but he'd written all over it.
You know what I do is I read it. I got to read it. So I'm up to 4 in the morning. If I interview someone who wrote a book, I have to respect that person and the book. I won't interview Harold Robbins or Rona Jaffe or Belva Plaine. Why? You know, why? Life is too short. I interview, let's say, Michael Arlen's new book. Michael Arlen, I'm going to miss him now because we goofed up on schedules. Or whoever it is I'm interviewing, you know, John Cheever when he was alive, you know, something. That's a different thing. You got to read. So I mark. I look for, now and then, look for a crazy kind of passage that I call revelatory, you know, that sets things on fire. But I mark it, and it looks like hieroglyphics, and it's a crazy goof. Sometimes I put music in. You see, sometimes it might be a book that I might, if I'm talking about, well, I did an interview, she died long ago, Flannery O'Connor. I read her short stories. I bring in some wild banjo music between us and a background of a story called Parker's Back or something. So I do all kinds of things. Sometimes the author's astonished by the music I choose. It's a song he remembered as a child, I just happened to pick out, or never heard of it, fits. So that's how I do it, like Mary Jane Phillips, you know, this wonderful writer of, what's the name of that book? Young writer.
Machine Dreams? Is that her?
That's it, Machine Dreams. Well, I found a certain piece of music there, World War II piece, another piece, and it set things off. She's a good writer, see.
Speaking with Studs Terkel, if you're just joining us, and as I'm sure you know, he hosts a syndicated radio show and has written several books of oral history. His latest is called The Good War, and it's an oral history of World War II. What do you do when you're interviewing a politician? I know you've interviewed political people, and they're not being straight with you. They're giving you like the line, or you're using like bureaucratic language to obscure what they're saying.
I don't interview political people, not during a campaign. Never. I don't do that, because then I got to have clouds on. I have no time. Again, I have no time for that. See, people say, why don't I have people of the real right on my show? I say, I got no time for that. I got no time. They got forums. They can be on. They got 1.5 million forums. God Almighty, they don't need. I'm sorry, but now and then, when my books, that's different. In my books, I want to get like in Hard Times. I interviewed Gerald L. K. Smith. Now, Gerald L. K. Smith was a very colorful American fascist. He was. He didn't deny it. He's dead now. He was known as an anti-Semite, and I had to interview him because he was in that time, the Depression. He had tremendous power in certain communities. Henry Ford brought him up north to fight the Union, you know, to split blacks and whites. But he was remarkably colorful. But I let him talk himself. Went to see him in Fayetteville in Eureka Springs, Arkansas. And so he's talking during the civil rights time. I interviewed him. He's talking about these young clergymen, these guys. I'm a clergyman. He says, don't call me Reverend, but just call me Mr. Smith. These guys hide behind that turned back collar as they're fighting for civil rights. Let them be like me. I face it. And the same breath, just about 2 seconds afterward, he's describing an event in the 30s. I was attacked. They almost tried to lynch me in Georgia, and I hopped on that rock. You know, Roosevelt guys tried to hop on the rock and say, who dares attack me? Attacks a man of God. So he's contradicting himself in the same breath. Let him do it. I don't do it, you see. But I have to capture people as they are.
When you interview someone for one of your books, I'm sure you can spend hours or days talking with them as much as you need. But for the radio show, you have, say, an hour.
Mm-hmm. And you have an hour, yeah.
When that hour's over, even if you feel like you've really gotten to hear a lot about that person, do you ever walk out feeling, well, how much do I really know? You know, and like, is the way they presented themselves in the hour really the essence of who they are?
Well, that always comes up. The author of a book, you try to get whatever the essence of the book is, the theme of the book, maybe read from it, too. He and I, or she and I, both read together. He and I read together, because I'm a ham bone, too. I used to be a Chicago gangster, you know, in radio soap operas. You know, I was a gangster in the days when radio soap operas, a lot of them came out of Chicago, Ma Perkins, you know. And then she was a good middle American family. I was always the guy who says, get in there, you guys. That was me. And then it was Mary Marlin. I gave her a very hard time. You know, she suffered more than St. Teresa ever did, Monday through Fridays, courtesy of Oxidol. But the one I remember best, Betty and Bob. You know why I remember that? The actress who played the role of Betty's mother, these were horrendous scripts. Oh, but the scripts were all the same. You couldn't tell one from the other, and they're very forgettable. But the actress, her name was Edie Davis, a very elegant-looking actress, silver-haired, and I used to threaten her in the soap opera. And then I forgot the script, I forgot her, I forgot what I did. Years passed, about 40 years passed. It's election night, 1980. President-elect Ronald Reagan, his wife, Nancy Davis Reagan, and references made to his wife's mother, the mother-in-law of the new president, Edie Davis. That's the woman I was in a soap opera with. And that's when I had what I call my epiphanic experience, what Joyce calls his epiphanic, my moment of revelation. I was Saul on the road to Damascus, right? And I got that blinding light. And you know what the revelation was?
What?
Thinking about Betty and Bob and Edie Davis and 40 years later and the president. You can no longer tell where soap opera leaves off when life begins. That's it. And it was a soap opera. The sky and the world we live in. A great man. And so this is what I find frightening. Funny, but frightening at the same time. But anyway, I always like metaphors and anecdotes, you know. In a way, if they reveal, if the anecdote becomes metaphorical, it has a value. Otherwise, I become a bore.
You have to read so many books to keep up with the people who you're interviewing. And you interview so many people. Do you ever feel like you can't cram in any more information, or that for a while you need to take a break from other people's lives?
Yeah, of course, feel it often. I feel it now, too. In a way, I feel so much, you know. There was a woman named Margaret Fuller. She was a great woman living in, you know, pre-Civil War. Margaret Fuller was one of the early feminists of the country. She's a great literary critic. She's the one who encouraged Hawthorne and Poe, and she worked for Horace Greeley. Margaret Fuller wanted to swallow the world like an oyster, as she put it one day. You know, so I want to swallow the world like an oyster, but I choke on it. It's too much. It's a big oyster. And yeah, that's too much. So you have to kind of, I haven't learned yet how to do it, how to ration energy, I think, and time. I never will. It's quite obvious I never will. But you have to learn it, though.
Well, what do you do when you feel like you're temporarily burned out on talking to people about their lives, and you just need a break for a while? It's not that you want to stop doing it, but you just have to.
It would be good to have a break. I haven't taken any, but it's about time I did. And then, well, you know, by the way, one thing on this radio show that I've done for 32 years now, this interviewing writers or read a short story. Yeah. People love to hear short stories read. And then you realize, why is it? I happen to enjoy reading short stories. Why is it? People haven't heard stories. People need stories told to them, the young particularly. No one's ever told them stories, you see. And storytelling is what literature is about. Storytelling is what history is about. Storytelling is what our lives are about.
I'm speaking with Studs Terkel, if you're just joining us, and he's had a very popular interview show on the radio, which is syndicated for many years. It originates at WFMT in Chicago. He's written several books of oral histories. His latest is called The Good War, and it's oral histories with men and women talking about their experiences during World War II. You've been in Chicago all your life, except for the times when you've been traveling. Why are you that committed to this city? What makes that city really special for you?
My roots are there. When Alex Haley wrote Roots, he was talking about a legacy, a heritage, Gambia, here. And by the way, whom did he go to see when he went back to do more research on his book, The Gambia, where his people came from in West Africa? The griots, oral historians, the storytellers. But Chicago is my home, and I'm there, and it's a kind of, even though I romanticize, a kind of muscularity to it and its reputation, thanks to Jimmy Cagney and Warner Brothers and Edward G. Robinson, is still boom, boom. You know, Chicago was always a corrupt city, but no more corrupt than other cities. But I call it the big daddy of corrupt cities. And as the respectables are secretly proud when someone goes, Chicago, boom, boom. They're secretly proud of it in a way.
Did you ever want to move to, like, the West Coast or the East Coast and go to New York or Los Angeles to work at one of the networks? You know, ABC,
would I
CBS,
do it?
NBC. Did you ever want to?
Never, never. Never in a million years. There was a time in the early 1950-51, I was a part of a program called Studs Place. It was early TV. There were three shows out of Chicago. Garraway at Large with Dave Garraway, who later became the first host of the Today program. Today revolutionized American morning habits. And Kukla Fran Ali with Bert Tilstrom, who's an absolute genius. And the show I was on, Studs Place. Now, all three of these shows had something in common. They had a feeling of improvisation and ease. And they were called TV Chicago Style. And the preeminent TV critic of the time was John Crosby, who then wrote for the New York Herald Tribune. And he raved about these three programs, Chicago Style. At that time, I got a call to come to New York. And I got so scared to direct Billy Rose, of all things, the Billy Rose program. And I said, no, I really couldn't. I didn't want to go there. I had no more business being there than the man. You know, the old cliche, good to visit, but that's it. No, so there was that one momentary offer. If I'd have died, it's like being without water, you know. My roots are in Chicago. I'm there. It's freewheeling as far as I'm concerned. Whether I could do it in another city, I don't know. It's free. I'm kind of a freewheeler, you know.
Have you ever lost any radio sponsors because of your politics?
Oh, way in the back. Oh, there was a period in the 50s. Before I came to the station, FMT, boy, there was an FMT. I was blacklisted. Oh, sure. Studs Place was knocked off for that reason. And so I remember a VP of... I was considered, forgive this phrase, a valuable property. Property is interesting. Because the show was quite popular. It was a kind of program that had an audience of cut through. It had an audience of mainline type ladies who write in a boss stationery, or a charwoman, a scrub lady signing with an ex. Her daughter writes the letter. Truck driver, college professor. It was one of those programs. We never, my theme was never to underestimate the audience, you know. Never. And someone says, you can't make that reference. I make a reference, say, to the Iliad. Oh, I know. It was no smoking. This is way before smoking was considered bad. A guy named Alton Oxner of Touro, the sanatorium in New Orleans, was talking about cigarettes being bad. So we had a program about going to cut out smoking. I was on cigarettes in those days. And we cut, and someone's puffing a cigar, and I love that smell. And I'm saying, oh, I'm Ulysses, tie me to the mast. We're passing the Isle of Circe. I says, you can't do that on the air. They wouldn't know what you're talking about. I says, I'm going to do it. And they may not know it now, but they'll find, let them find it. It's okay. I'm going to do it. And that's the way we'd make references. Because I felt like, never underrate the audience. Well, anyway, the show was, finally, it was the McCarthy time, and I signed petitions, anything, you know, anti-Jim Crow. That was considered subversive back then. This, I'm talking about the 50s now, before the 60s. Oh, whatever I signed, price control, rent control. So I'm called to this office in Chicago, and they tell me, gee, I'm a valuable guy. Why am I doing this? You know, I said, well, all I got to say is I've been duped. See, you've been a fool. But I wasn't. I said, see, it's my own ego. It's not my heroism. It's my ego. How dare you say I was? It's one of the few good things I did. I said, of course I signed it. Well, you know, some Reds signed it too. I said, I don't give a damn if they did. I'm reading what it says. And I like that. And I signed it. Well, you weren't duped. Do you want to say, no, I don't want to be look like a fool. It's my ego, you see. So then he says, you know, you got to, an American, you got to stand up and be counted. So I'm sitting in a chair. So I stood up at attention. And they said, we don't think that's very funny. I said, well, I think it's kind of funny. Anyway, you're out, you know. I says, yeah, I guess so. So I was out, you know, for quite a while, off and on.
Was it hard to get back on the air after that?
Well, off and on. You see, the Chicago newspaper guys liked me. I'm from Chicago. I'm one of theirs. So I never had it in the papers. It was a trade secret. The public never knew about it. You know, see. But I'd have tough. I'd get pick up a half a bill here and there lecturing on jazz or something. And finally got back on. And one day I was listening to this small station called WFMT. And they're playing a Woody Guthrie record. Well, no one ever played Woody Guthrie on the radio except me on a disc jockey show I did. Years in 1945 called The Wax Museum. And they played Woody. I forget the song. It might have been Tom Joad or Going Down the Road Feeling Bad, a Dust Bowl ballad. And I call up and say, you're playing Woody Guthrie. And I told my name. And she said, oh, they knew me. She says, I said, listen, I want to work for you. She says, we have no money. And I said, I don't have any either, so it makes us even. So I started working at that station. Well, the station became a very good classical music station, probably the best, if I say so, the best in the country. It is. It carries Chicago Symphony, live, lyric opera, Salzburg Festival, you know, Glyndebourne, BBC programs. And I'm one. It's one aberration. I do my 1 hour. And so the station grew, and there I am. And as a result of being on that station, one thing led to another. A publisher named Andre Schifrin of Pantheon, who is very important in all these books, heard one of the interviews and thought maybe I should do something, an oral history about an American city, Chicago. And thanks to the Blacklist, I'm doing it. Now, I don't say, by the way, I'm not subscribing this as therapy.
Did you grow up in a liberal family? Was your mother
liberal? No, hardworking. My father was a liberal. My mother was out for the brass ring, you know. And she missed. She ran the hotel. My father did too, but he was ill. And she was pretty shrewd, pretty bright in money matters. But nobody could take her except a guy named Samuel Insull, who was a big utilities tycoon. Took a lot of people to Chicago then. But she always missed the brass ring. But in the hotel where I was raised in this hotel, it was a men's hotel. But in those days, when you say men's hotel, you don't mean flop house. The word flop, this was not. This was skilled craftsmen living there. I'm talking about the 20s now. Transient guys who were boomer firemen, carpenters, guys skilled. And a lot of them were self-educated, were autodidacts, you know, and self-taught. And they were argued in the lobby, and that was a big factor in my life, I'd say.
Yeah, you know, I was wondering if growing up in a hotel helped get you interested in other people's lives, because, you know, most of us just live with our nuclear family when we're growing up.
Oh, the hotel was a big factor.
You live with dozens of different people.
The hotel was, I would say, a big factor. Oh, sure it was.
Would you talk to people when you were a kid who were roommates?
Well, I don't know. I was there. I was kind of the pet. I was a happy child. I was kind of the pet, you know, of the guys and of the people, of my family, too. And I'd go to see plays when I was 13 years old, because we lived right near downtown, the Loop, the hotel. And so I liked to see. So one thing led to another, really.
You went to law school and then left that in favor of acting and then radio
law
performance.
School.
Yeah, why'd you leave law school?
I went to law school, the dream of Clarence Darrow, you know, attorney of the damned. That was the dream. But then I had torts, and then I had contracts, then I had real property. And then this is incredible. I can't hit these legalisms. So it was three unhappy years for me. And people say, you never lose. You know, you never forget law school. Always is good. Baloney. It was three wasted years. I might as well say it.
You still feel that way?
Absolutely. Three wasted years. I've blocked it out. I have no memory of any of these things. I just blocked it out. An 8-year-old child knows more of law than I do. I could have studied anthropology or literature or sociology or something. Sure.
How'd you break into acting after that?
Again, accidental. The depression. There was a depression. And I had a civil service job in Washington. And you dream. I dreamed of a civil service job. 9 to 5. And it paid $12.60 a year. It was the second lowest, CAF-2 it was called. And we'd count baby bonds. The World War I veterans got a second bonus payoff. And we had one of these big examinations. It took 3-4 days. The cream of the crop were picked. And then it was count. But any event, I came back to Chicago, and I was on a statistical project at the time, a New Deal project. And one of the members of it was a director of a theater group. And they were doing a play called Waiting for Lefty by Clifford Odets, a play of the 30s. And I went there because I like theater. He's going to stage, do a role, read it. And that's how I became an actor. And I was in the first play I was in was Waiting for Lefty. It was about a taxi cab driver strike. Clifford Odets, who became the playwright of Social Significance of the 30s, Awake and Sing, and all those.
Do you miss acting now? I know you still act a little.
I'm a ham. I'd like now and then. The last thing I did, would you believe it, was Eddie Carboni in View from the Bridge. I like doing that. I did George and Of Mice and Men and Sir Ryan. I like doing Sir Ryan. Well, I'd like to do, if I do one more, either Beckett. I'd like to do Crap's Last Tape or one of the tramps in Waiting for Godot.
Speaking with Studs Terkel, if you're just joining us, and he is the host of a very, very popular radio series, as I'm sure you know, that originates in Chicago and is syndicated. He's also written several very popular books that are oral histories. His latest is called The Good War, and it's an oral history of World War II. You know your book Working, where you interviewed people about their day-to-day lives on their job. Mm-hmm. Did that change your views a lot about you know what I think of? In your memoir, Talking to Myself, you talk about a scene in the movie Five Easy Pieces in which... Why don't you share impressions of that? Because that's such a classic scene, love what you have to say about it.
Five Easy Pieces. I know young listeners love this movie, and it was a good, slick movie. I say slick. And it was very good. It just happened. Before seeing, I interviewed a waitress for the book Working. I remember her name. She's now dead. She was a wonderful woman. I'm Yolanda Leaf. I call her Dolores Dante in the book. Now and then change your name. But in almost every case, I say, we should use my real name. I do it maybe because they might be embarrassed, but they weren't. Anyway, so I view this. She's describing her daily work, a waitress, her work. And then I see the movie. And the key scene in that movie, the one they use all the time in the Academy Awards, is this virago. Here's Jack Nicholson. I'm not blaming him. I'm talking about the character. This guy's going to go to Alaska. He's a great piano virtuoso. And my feeling is, go ahead. I'm not stopping you. You want to go to Alaska? Go ahead. You're a pretty dull guy, you know? And I mean, this is the self-indulgence. I'm talking about the character. And he's there with these companions in this restaurant. And here comes the villain, the waitress, the virago. And soon she comes on, you know, she's a wrongo. She looks at what he throws the menu down. He's got to have a change. I forget the exact scene. But they want a substitution. There's no substitution. Suddenly, and she's behaving so bad that he throws the stuff on the floor. And the kids in the audience, seeing the film, stood up and they cheered. And I'm saying, you little, can I use the word? You little shits, you know who you are. You can do that. I'm saying, you little so-and-sos, you don't know who this waitress is. This is a setup. Is she tired? How are varicose veins? Waitresses get a lot of varicose veins. So do stewardesses on planes. And so, you know what? How many bufferins did she take? Why is she a waitress? The husband left her. He's dead. He's sick. Kid's in trouble. How tired is she? Did she have a fight with the chef just then behind the doors? They know nothing about her, other than they cheered when he was showing her up. Well, I was so furious about that, because it tells those kids, these people who work aren't much. These are the same yuppies today on the campuses who raise the flag of voting. They know nothing, nothing about history or the nature of life, you know. And their boy is going to win, you know. And so I was so furious. Well, working taught me, yeah. It taught me. I'm impatient a lot with a telephone operator. No, I know what a telephone operator's life is like. But the great reward comes when I get a letter now and then from somebody. Or this was a young priest walking along the Michigan Avenue Bridge teaching at a school, at a seminary. And he says, you know, my kid said to me, on reading Working, he had Working assigned, they'll never again talk to a waitress the way they did before. Or they'll never again talk to a truck driver the way they did. Well, that's good stuff. That's a reward, yeah. If it can alter a person's attitude, a book, well, you got something.
I guess it changed your attitude, too, about something.
I guess all those books, one way or another, did. One way played a role.
You've referred several times to Ronald Reagan and to young conservative people who would be voting for him. Why do you think that there is, after a kind of wave of radicalism in the 60s and early 70s, now a wave of conservatism?
Well, I wish I could answer that question. One thing, or here's my theory, better or for worse. One theory. Remember, we speak of no sense of past, no sense of history. There's no memory. They were born, you know the phrase, I wasn't born yesterday. They weren't born yesterday. They were born this morning. See, we've taught that which is new, the stuff is shot at us moment after moment in the commercials, politically, the image, the substance, no. The shadow, yes. And so that's it. And so they at this moment they're living. Also, I think a change in the educational system. Think of it. Ever since Sputnik, the emphasis has been on math and science, but mostly high tech now. There's business administration. You got money. That's now more sexy than sex itself. You've got the TV programs, even public television, and it's money programs. You've got sections of newspapers, business sections, you know, financial sections, Wall Street Journal. There's no labor section, is there, ever? And so we speak of Mondale being catcher of big labor. No one speaks of corporate America and their little errand boy, their water boy, the little huckster for General Electric. Ronnie Reagan, the second-rate actor. Incredible. And so these kids know nothing about it. Oh, then by God, we got to stand tall. Well, standing tall comes from a physical ed instructor, not from a president, you know. His physical ed says stand tall. But that's not a requisite for the presidency, is it, to say to stand tall? But I'm talking about also something else, and that's the big thing, machismo. The John Waynes. We got our nose bloodied by little guys in black pajamas. We had no business being there in the first place. And we can't get over the fact that we got our nose bloodied. So along comes another little guy in the corner called Grenada, and we're going to wallop Grenada. And we're cheering. It's like Muhammad Ali in his prime knocking off a little amateur flyweight. We're cheering. All our lives we're taught as kids to challenge the bully happens that we become the bully, and we rationalize it. We stop and grenade at the Cuban airport. Now we know it was a fake. We know that there was a we finished the airports for tourists and not military. And now the students saying they were saved by us. Who are they kidding? We know they changed their minds. They were told to, and so was the head of the university. And so we attack. We got to win something. And so, you know, Grenada's going to fly in. They're going to attack us, you know. Grenada is, you know. This is incredible. I thought, and here comes the moment of despair for me. When I heard that the administration is attacking Grenada, I thought he's going to be laughed off the stage. That's it. Instead, cheers. Then you realize it isn't Reagan. It's something happened to our country. Oh, back to the educational system. So there's business administration courses emphasized, engineering courses, high-tech courses, the silicon chippies at work. You know, and so they're all there, you know. And what's happened to the humanities? So less and less of the humanities are taught, you know, music, literature, anthropology, sociology. I think the word humanities is not unrelated to humanity. And the horrible thing about many of the young, and this is the generality, because many of the young are questioning, but the great many, is there's no shame anymore when a contempt for those up against it. It's been told many times. There's no shame. On one of the television programs, George Will is on with Sam Donaldson Sunday morning. Now, Donaldson is not Eugene V. Debs, but he looks like Debs at this moment because Will is, they're talking about Nicaragua. We might invade Nicaragua. And he's saying, well, Will says that's not going to affect the American public about another Nicaraguan terrorist knocked off. He's referring to the heads of the government. And that's when Donaldson says to him, oh, you mean it's okay for us to assassinate leaders there, but if they did, it'd be war. He says, yeah. And they all laughed. See, there's no shame anymore. That used to be hidden, and there's no shame. And it's the shamelessness that I find so incredible, too, at this moment. So something is happening to us that's beyond Reagan. And that's why Reagan's there. That's my point.
You say there's something happening to us. There's also, I think, a real emphasis on success now. There's like a new success ethic. How do you feel
about
that?
You make it no matter what. You know, that is, you got to make it. You go to school to make the grade, to make the grade. And if you're successful, no matter how you do it, you gouge, you out-trick the other, whatever it is, ethics is gone, in a sense. But mostly fair play. We always taught Americans fair play.
Has success been important to you in your life? You know, like setting goals and achieving them and becoming
well, I suppose, the approbation of my peers, I suppose, a matter of ego. Money success, not really, no. I don't mind. I like good cigars, you know, and a shot of whiskey. Too. I like to have dough, but not, I like to have dough so I could here and then pitch in on something that I believe in, you know, Clergy Laity Concerned or Nation Magazine or something like that, you know, or Highlander Folk School.
In your book, Working, you interviewed a lot of people who had 9-to-5 jobs that they did and that were hard, but it wasn't a kind of like life's work to them. It wasn't, for some it was, but I mean, for some of the people, they were like waitresses and wished that they didn't have to do it. You've had the opportunity to have a kind of life's work that is very meaningful to you. Yeah. Do you consider that like a great gift
It's a lucky, a fortune, good fortune. For me, it's good fortune. Because imagine a great many people are doing work of which they don't see the end result. You see, the guy who's a spot welder in a plant, in contrast to the old cabinet maker, makes the whole thing. But also, see, remember, Freud in Civilization Discontents spoke of work, Leben und Arbeiten, love and work, or sex and work, as the two prime impulses of human beings. And so there were a lot of books about sex, but very few about work at the time Working came out, you know. And so that was the dirty little secret, dirty big secret, work. D.H. Lawrence called sex dirty little secret. But work was the dirty big secret, because work is an extension of a person. And if that work is meaningless, the person's life becomes meaningless, you see. And so talking about work became terribly important to a great many people.
Since your work is really fulfilling, do you ever want to retire from it?
No, with my shoes turned up. Now, how could I retire? How could I retire? I'd have to be fired or, you know, knocked off. It's as long as I can talk. Or if I feel my marbles are lessening, you know, and if I got to feel that my standards are going down. If they are, I'd have to. My model would be the late Lotta Lehmann, the great leader singer from the greatest of a century. Lotta Lehmann retired one day. She surprised her audience at town hall. She was no more than 60, if she was at 61. She says, this is my last performance, and it's on recording, and I have it. It's a fantastic moment. And nobody, even her accompanist, Paul Lalusky, doesn't know it. And the only time, no, she's, yes, let me tell you why. She's known for a famous role, the Marshalin in The Rosen Cavalier. And the Marshalin sees the first wrinkle. Still a beautiful woman, 35 maybe, gives up her young lover to the young girl. And she's the Marshalin taught me something. When that moment, when my height is lessening, I'm finishing. And she became a great teacher, of course. But Lotta Lehmann, to me, is a model of the way things should be for someone who's proud of his or her work.
Well, I really enjoy your work, and it's really been such a great pleasure to meet you today. I really thank you for being here this afternoon.
Thank you for your provocative questions, thank God.